From Michigan Radio, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Attorney General is filing criminal charges against six more state employees in connection with the contamination of Flint water.
And they say what they're doing here is working their way up the ladder, up the chain of bureaucracy, targeting higher and higher and higher levels. And they say that they're not done yet.
So far, no go on a better public transit system in the Detroit Metro.
They say, why should those taxpayers in our out-county areas be forced to pony up for this millage when they're not going to get any service for it?
After the political conventions, all the voters are fired up for the primary elections in Michigan, right?
August primaries in Michigan usually have dismal turnout. We look at 20% as a high watermark, which is pretty depressing.
Those stories and more, but first the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette is charging six more state employees in connection with the contamination of Flint's drinking water supply.
Their job was to ensure that the families of Flint had safe water to drink. They failed.
Joining us is Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta. Is it a surprise that six employees from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services are charged today?
No, this is not a surprise in the sense that the Attorney General and others in this investigation had always said more criminal charges are coming. What's striking about this is the level at which we're talking about now, that this is the state's former water quality chief over at the State Department of Environmental Quality, high-ranking DEQ officials who had decision-making authority regarding what to do with these reports that warned that there might be a problem with lead contamination, and they're accused of covering it up. The other thing is now for the first time on the criminal side of this, we're seeing the State Department of Health and Human Services brought into the mix. They say that there are also some public health officials who are implicated in this. And what they say that they're doing now, remember that two state employees had already been charged. A city of Flint water supervisor has pleaded guilty and struck a deal where he would cooperate. And they say what they're doing here is working their way up the ladder, up the chain of bureaucracy, targeting higher and higher and higher levels. And they say that they're not done yet.
So let's be clear. These are allegations. These are charges. But this is really interesting to see. I mean, we're talking about misconduct in office. We're talking about tampering with evidence. We're talking about conspiracy and tampering with evidence. These charges in the MDEQ employees are pretty darn serious. But the one that really caught my eye was at the Department of Health and Human Services, and that is somebody is alleged to have hid an internal report on blood lead level data in Flint children.
Right. And that is certainly one that stands out because, you know, this started out with complaints about blood levels in children. And this would suggest that if true, high-level state employees knew about this and then acted to cover it up because it didn't fit the narrative that they were trying to make.
So if this is not the end of the charges, as Attorney General Bill Schuette says, how many more people could get caught up in this investigation?
We don't know, but Andy Arena, he is the former FBI Detroit bureau chief who's now the lead investigator in the state's inquiry, and he says he would not be surprised if this wound up as the largest criminal investigation in Michigan history.
That's just shocking. All right, that's Rick Pluta with Michigan Radio. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Glad to do it, Lester.
My colleague Steve Carmody has been covering the Democratic National Convention. Steve, you covered the Republicans. Now you've covered the Democrats. From a Michigan perspective, how do you compare and contrast the two?
Well, in the end, I guess it depends on which Michigan you're talking to. I think the Republicans were very effective in reaching out to white, male, blue-collar Michiganders, voters who are concerned about trade, about immigration. On the other hand, the Democrats were very effective on reaching out to other Michiganders, gay, Muslim, Michigan women, and dealing with the issues that are facing them. So I think each convention had a targeted audience in Michigan, and each reached that audience.
The Democratic convention was expected to be divisive. Some supporters of Bernie Sanders did walk out of the convention, and many of them say they won't support or vote for Hillary Clinton. How does that affect the party in Michigan?
it's not good for your party if people who are there as delegates to your national convention are openly talking about voting for a third-party candidate. And there were quite a few Bernie Sanders delegates who were saying just that. And a lot of the people who came from Michigan who stood outside of the Wells Fargo Center and protested, that's not a good sign. So that's something that the Democrats are going to have to work on over the next 4 months to bring in as many of those folks in from the cold and have them be part of the Democratic Party. But again, it's a lot of work that the Democrats are going to have to do to heal these divisions and make the case that they can continue to support Bernie Sanders by voting for Hillary Clinton.
Flint was brought up a couple of times at the Democratic convention. Flint Mayor Karen Weaver spoke. Also, former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm talked about Flint.
When Flint's water poisons its children, it hurts all of us. These are our children. We are all Flint.
So I'm wondering, in what way is Flint a symbol now?
Well, it depends on what you want to use it as a symbol for. For the Republicans, last week in Cleveland, Attorney General Bill Schuette talked about it as a city that needs justice, that has been victimized by government in general. For the Democrats, they were using it to point the finger at Republican-style government and what has happened to the people in the city of Flint. So it's a symbol, but it just depends on what your starting base is to what that symbol means.
Michigan's next big political event, of course, is the August 2nd primary election next week. How might the conventions affect voters' perceptions of the parties and their choices next week?
That's a really good question, because I'm not sure how much people were paying attention to the conventions to get an idea of who they should be voting for in the primary. When we looked around this week and last week in Cleveland, you didn't see anybody who's running in the primaries here. They were all back in their home districts campaigning for votes. So I'm not really sure if what we're going to see on August 2nd is going to be reflective of what has been happening at the conventions in Cleveland and Philadelphia.
Well, Steve, we'll be glad to have you back in Michigan. Thanks for all the reporting you did at both conventions. That's got to be grueling. I know you've put some long days and late nights in. Thanks much. Joining us, as they do most Fridays, are Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. So the Republicans and Democrats have officially chosen their nominees. It's a Trump-Clinton race. I wonder what stands out for you in each party convention. Susan, what are your impressions of the conventions now that we've seen them both?
Well, I think there was a pretty sharp contrast in tone. The Democratic National Convention reminded me very much of Republican national conventions of old. There was a lot of talk about national security, a lot of stress on being steady and having leadership in the world, themes that, you know, George W. Bush used to carry extremely well. The Republican National Convention was the Donald Trump show, which is what we all expected it to be. I think the party has somewhat unified around him, but it was definitely a blow for Ted Cruz to get up on stage and not endorse him.
Ken Sikkema, how do you think the two conventions compared?
Hey, Lester, my takeaway is the Republican convention was better than it could have been. Given the nominee, there was always this underlying potential for, you know, a disaster, to be honest with you, in terms of something he might have said or whatever. And that really didn't happen. So, like I said, my big takeaway is Republican convention was pretty decent from their standpoint, and the polling would indicate that Trump actually got a bump out of that.
I want to ask you both a question. I asked my colleague Steve Carmody earlier, what kind of effect might the conventions have on next week's primary elections? Did the parties fire up their voters? Susan?
Well, I think, as we all know, August primaries in Michigan usually have dismal turnout. We look at 20% as a high watermark, which is pretty depressing. I think there's usually a pretty big detachment between what's going on nationally and people actually turning up in Michigan. Usually the party conventions are a lot later on, so perhaps people will be more politically engaged after, you know, the two major parties were on TV nonstop. But to be honest, I think we're probably looking at traditional turnout levels. A lot of people are on vacation. A lot of people still are not paying attention.
Ken, this race for president is different than those in the past in a lot of different ways. How do you think that might spill over into races at the congressional level and those for the Michigan House?
I don't think the conventions are going to have any impact on next week's primary, per se. I mean, my goodness, after 2 weeks of nonstop TV coverage, if anything, people are probably sick of politics right now and want to watch the Olympics, you know. So I just don't think the conventions themselves have an impact on next Tuesday's election. Now, the November election, that's a different story.
I want to throw something out. While social media has been a factor in the last several elections, I don't recall as many tweets and Facebook postings from as many people as I've seen the last couple of weeks. While the disapproval ratings for both Clinton and Trump are high, people do seem more engaged, at least if social media is a measure of that. Is that something you've seen? And if so, what do you make of it, Susan?
I definitely think that social media has become just a critical part of campaigns now, and you are seeing more political engagement than ever. But especially when you look at things like Twitter, it's a very small percentage of voters who are actually on social media. And those people on Facebook, you know, tend to be posting pictures of their family as opposed to really be engaging in the political process. But I think those of us who are in the media and are in politics tend to overestimate the effect.
We're getting a distorted view. Ken, what do you think?
Well, if you want a distorted view, I'm the guy to ask, because social media continues to be a mystery to me and probably most people at my age. But, you know, the pervasive nature of it is obvious. What I find kind of interesting is how the Democrats have sort of used it against Trump this week, you know, basically saying, hey, do you want a president who tweets? You know, so all of a sudden the use of social media, at least the way he's used it, is actually kind of becoming an issue.
Well, we've also got a 90-year-old former congressman who's pretty good with Twitter as well, so I guess we're stuck with it regardless. That's Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants, and Susan Demas is publisher at Inside Michigan Politics. They joined us via Skype. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. Yesterday, the Southeast Michigan Regional Transit Authority took a vote at getting a millage proposal on the ballot, and it failed. Representatives on the RTA board from Oakland and Macomb counties nixed it. So time is running out to get this proposal on the ballot, and everybody seems to be digging in their heels. Here's what's at stake. The Detroit Metro has one of the most dysfunctional public transportation systems of any major city in the nation. Smart Bus in the suburbs doesn't really work with DDOT, the bus system in Detroit. This proposal would have established the suburb to city routes so people could get to jobs, to ball games, or whatever else they needed, and is seen necessary by a lot of the region's leaders for the economy. So what's going on? Here to help us understand is Sarah Swick, who was at the meeting yesterday. So Sarah, by all appearances, the county executive of Oakland County, L. Brooks Patterson, and the county executive of Macomb County, Mark Hackle, aren't happy and aren't willing to even let their citizens vote on this. Why?
Well, there are two main reasons that they give that are sort of the, you know, reasons that they will give publicly. The first one has to do with the fact that, you know, some of the areas of Oakland and Macomb counties that are more the out county areas that are further away from the city of Detroit, from sort of the central metro area, aren't really covered under this plan. So they say, why should those taxpayers in our out county areas be forced to pony up for this millage when they're not going to get any service for it? Another concern that they raise is the governance structure of the RTA, the Regional Transit Authority itself, which is a little more tricky to deal with, actually, because this was something that was written into law by the state legislature in 2012. And basically, they want to change how the RTA would have to vote on major funding decisions so that they would have to have essentially a supermajority for every funding vote with one, or not necessarily a supermajority, but at least one vote from each county or each jurisdiction that's represented on the board. So essentially, it would make it much harder to pass any sort of funding measures if it doesn't have total, almost unanimous support.
If that was a concern, why didn't they bring this up a long time ago?
Well, they say that they did, or they have been bringing it up at least for many months since late last year. I think the question is, you know, not being exactly sure of what's going on behind the scenes, was how sort of vehement they were being about it and sort of how seriously their concerns were taken by some of the other members of the board here, and whether they were seen as, oh, yes, maybe they have some concerns, but are they going to torpedo the whole regional transit plan if those concerns are not addressed? And we found out, I think, just last week that, in fact, they were willing to do that.
So there's some underlying hostility here. There's been some bad feelings between the counties and Detroit ever since the bankruptcy. So why is that affecting this decision?
Yes. So there have been some bad feelings. There's some political tensions in Detroit's bankruptcy, sort of going back a little bit. It sort of brought in all of the regional players, especially dealing with the water system, which essentially became regionalized under the Great Lakes Water Authority. But the heads of Oakland Macomb County, Elbergs Patterson and Mark Hackle, didn't really like how that whole deal went down. They felt that was sort of shoved down their throat through the federal court, and they didn't really like it. And there are some other political tensions and undercurrents running along here that have to sort of do with, you know, city, suburb, and even sort of divisions, I guess, within maybe the Republican Party between Governor Snyder and Brooks Patterson. But the basic fact is that Macomb and Oakland County sort of didn't like how a lot of these new regional authorities that are being formed, they didn't like how the power structure was sort of playing out in those. And maybe they saw an opportunity here to swing the balance in their favor, and they seem to be taking it.
So, as I mentioned before, it's running out of time. What's next? And if they don't get this proposal on the ballot now, when's the next opportunity?
Well, what seems to be the only option at this point, and this was stated pretty forthrightly at the meeting, which is that basically they have to get the county executives of the four counties, which include Wayne and Washtenaw counties, as well as Oakland and Macomb, and the mayor of the city of Detroit, probably all in a room together over the next few days somewhere. And they're going to have to try and see if they can hash out any of these differences, if it's even possible at this point to sort of make the changes that Oakland and Macomb seem to want to make. If by some sort of miracle, it would seem at this point, they can come to some kind of deal, then the RTA board would need to vote on it probably by next week. They're saying it definitely within the next couple of weeks, because this needs to be certified and put on the ballot by mid-August. Now, if it doesn't end up happening, which admittedly seems pretty unlikely that it will at this point, the thought is that this probably sets any plan to really boost regional transit in Metro Detroit back at least 2 and probably 4 years, because it needs to be on a general election ballot. And in 2 years, it would compete with the renewal of the millage for the regional bus system, SMART. So it really will set back things by a few years.
Right, bad timing there. Okay, that's Sarah Swick with Michigan Radio. She's talking to us about the Southeast Michigan Regional Transit Authority trying to get a millage that would have raised about $3 billion over 20 years to help a $4.6 billion master plan for Metro Detroit's mass transit system. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've heard business leaders of all kinds on this program talk about the need for more skilled workers in Michigan. Law enforcement agencies are also calling for more skilled employees. Kent County Sheriff Larry Stelma recently issued a report calling for more support for community colleges. Those schools are home to most of Michigan's police academies. Sheriff Stelma joins us now. What kind of support do you want for community colleges?
Well, we would like to see community colleges start the training programs, even incorporate these training programs even into their pre-college curriculum, where juniors and seniors in high school have access to some advanced training, and get them started at an earlier age. We'd like to see them provide some real serious career counseling, so that when young people do go into public safety fields, that they have a better idea as to what they're getting into, that they're better suited for it, and maybe avoid some of the pitfalls that new recruits can fall into.
I also saw in a release that you're looking to make student advising more accessible, as you just mentioned, foster accountability for results. In other words, encourage community colleges to report a percentage of students who transfer to and complete a degree at a four-year institution or the percentage retrained from the first to second. Also things like just simplifying the applications for funding, for grants, for loans and things like that. Some of that's going to require some help from the legislature. Have you been in contact with lawmakers in Lansing?
Yes, we have. The different organizations that different organizations are supporting different aspects of the proposal. We've been involved with legislature in Lansing for Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, all the way from, you know, even before school, right through college. The emphasis needs to be on better educating our young people.
What kind of skills do potential deputies need, or anybody who's thinking about law enforcement for a career?
You know, television and the movies would portray an officer as being some knuckle-dragging goon, and that is the furthest thing from the truth. Law enforcement officers have to be highly intelligent, highly motivated, people that have skills in writing, in math, skills in geometry. We need officers that know technology and can maximize the use of technology, both as technology allows crimes to be committed, frauds and the pornography and things that go on with technology that are antisocial, but as much there's a lot of need to be able to use technology to solve the crime. And a lot of technology goes into crime investigation nowadays. So there is a broad spectrum of requirements for officers.
You're quoted as saying you can't just give someone a uniform and ask them to become a deputy. But I got to tell you, in a lot of rural counties around the country, there are a lot of people who get little training beyond a firearms course. How is that changing?
Well, in Michigan, you have to pass the MCOLS licensing test. And I think Michigan has led the way in testing of its law enforcement officers. They've had a high standard for officers for years and years and years. And in my travels and contacts with agencies across the nation, most states are going to very similar categories for a post, some they call them different things, post training and pre-employment training and things of that sort. But in Michigan, we call it the Michigan Commission on Law Enforcement Standards. And it's a pretty intensive test and make sure that prospective officers are well-rounded.
The news release I saw indicates business leaders are joining you in this effort to get more people into post-secondary education. Is this also about recruiting non-traditional students to go to school? You mentioned starting with juniors and seniors in high school, but there are a lot of folks who are just barely getting by who are in their 20s and maybe early 30s.
Well, it is also a second career of choice. There are any number of applicants and people who want to get into public safety as a second career. You know, the first career in sales or the first career in accounting or whatever wasn't fulfilling, and they want to see something more community-orientated, and we'll look to this. We also see any number of individuals coming out of the military who have been trained by the military and have different academics through the military, and they come out and they say, you know, I want to continue my life in public service in this capacity, either as a communications officer in a dispatch center, a corrections officer in a jail, or an enforcement officer or a fire personnel someplace. But public safety seems to be experiencing a little bit of a resurgence here of interest of late.
Community colleges, of course, are less expensive than universities, but for some of these non-traditional students you're talking about, it takes time and it takes money, and that's hard to come up with. Are there any kinds of ways to night schools, weekend schools, something like that that can help folks who want to make that shift get there?
Well, we're kind of blessed here in Kent County with the Grand Rapids Community College. They're one of the few academies that has a two- or three-tiered approach. How they do that, they have the academy both as part of a two-year associate degree. If you come in already with an associate degree or a bachelor's degree or a degree in something else, you can go straight to the academy in like a 12 or 14-week academy. They have day classes, they have night classes, they have an expedited class for the military veterans. And so there are options that the academic institution can also employ to increase the number of opportunities for kids.
How long do you think this is all going to take? If you have a need for staff now, we're talking about some time for training, and you need to get some of these things you're talking about fixed in order to make that easier.
Well, we need them fixed quickly because the need continues to exasperate itself. Back in the early 90s, many agencies, including mine, saw some times, some days, some years of rapid growth. Now those officers have their 25, 27, 30 years in, and they're ready to move on. And there will be some big gaps in a lot of agencies in the next 2 to 4 years just because of the natural cycle of life.
That's Larry Stelma. He is the sheriff of Kent County. We've been talking about the need for more skills for potential law enforcement personnel. Thanks for taking the time to tell us about this.
Thank you. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You too.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In recent weeks, we've been taking you into the shops and workshops of people who make and repair things with their hands. We're calling it Artisans of Michigan. A blacksmith shop has a smell like no other. It's the coal in the forge, the hot steel.
I did forget to give you the safety warning. Everything in here is dirty or sharp or possibly very hot.
We're visiting Waterloo Metalworks to talk to John Ryer about what it's like to be a blacksmith today.
70 years ago, your blacksmith may have been the mechanic in a village. He would have been the one fixing your buggies, your wagons, your tooling. And while there are certainly blacksmiths today that do tooling, production, industrial work, most of the ones that I bump into are artistic blacksmiths or ornamental blacksmiths. We do a lot of work on buildings, railings, lighting fixtures, pot racks, things like that.
If you had to make a living as not an ornamental blacksmith, just fixing broken hitches and things like that, could you make a living?
Then I would be a mechanic, and I would probably be making a better living.
So why be a blacksmith?
Because when the Great Recession hit, I lost my job of 22 years, and I had been doing this kind of on the side as a way to learn a craft. I had an office job, and I wanted to learn a craft, something that maybe not would leave a legacy, but would give me some inspiration to get through my day. And I found a wonderful master blacksmith that taught me this craft. And I did it for a little while. I did it as a journeyman and then got my full-time job back because it paid really well and it gave me insurance and things like that. In 2009, that job went away. So I had to find a way to make a living. This is the only other thing I knew how to do.
So I'm center punching the steel first to give the drill bit somewhere to bite.
He's not just about hammer and tongs, although there are a lot of those in the shop. He uses a power hammer, too. He says it only makes sense, it's just efficient, and yeah, it's really loud. He's not alone here. He offers lessons, and his apprentice, Luke Blau, has his leather apron on watching John Ryer at work.
I've always admired blacksmiths, and I just love to see how they work, how they're there with the metal. They can have their hands right there on the work. It's not something that's on a screen. Something that's interested me.
When did you first see a blacksmith at work?
Probably when I was 10, 11, somewhere around there. I would like to look at swords and stuff like that. So I'd see that and wonder where they came from and watch the blacksmith and just, from that, started liking them.
There are a lot of blacksmiths who start with blades, those knives and swords. There's even a cable TV show where they compete, but Ryer's metalwork is forged architectural work. Railings, furniture. He'll do some repair work too, but a lot of this is stuff for houses and nice buildings. That architectural work is his specialty. He's done the work all over, Alaska, New York, Virginia, the Bahamas, Ecuador, and of course a lot here in Michigan.
I don't have a particular style myself. You know, maybe some people can look at my work and they say, yes, that's John Ryer's work. I'd like to do whatever the client wants, so whatever comes in the door is what I make.
But you're doing a lot of Art Nouveau stuff here.
If I had a choice, and if I was only going to do one thing, it would probably be Art Nouveau. It's my favorite thing. It's botanical. It doesn't always have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be perfectly symmetrical. You know, if it looks right, it is.
That's John Ryer with Waterloo Metalworks, Stateside's latest subject in our Artisans of Michigan series. You can see some photos of his shop and his work on our website. That's michiganradio.org. Up next, the Truth Booth is coming to Detroit and Flint. Find out what that's all about. Then in 10 minutes, thousands of homes in Michigan are at risk of tax foreclosure. But the state wants you to know there are programs to help. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, it's been kind of noisy the last couple of weeks with all the political conventions, all the speeches, the shouting, the protesters. It's been a noisy campaign season altogether, and that's left our country a little angry, a little fractured. All these voices, all these viewpoints. Well, there's a whole bunch of you we haven't heard from, and now here's your chance. There's a new thing called the Truth Booth in the U.S. It starts this Sunday in Bloomfield Hills. That's when the Cranbrook Art Museum will launch the Southeast Michigan leg of the public artwork In Search of the Truth, or the Truth Booth. Laura Mott is here with us. She's curator of contemporary art and design at the Cranbrook Art Museum. And Will Sylvester is here. He's an artist with Cause Collective, the group behind this project. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Will, you're taking the Truth Booth around the country. Just tell me what it is real quickly.
The Truth Booth is a 14-foot tall, 26-foot wide inflatable speech bubble where you can walk into it and there's a video recording interface where you'll have up to 2 minutes to say whatever the truth is to you.
And you're asking people to complete one sentence when they step inside the booth. What's that sentence?
We're asking people to finish the statement, the truth is.
For them.
Yes, for them, whatever that means.
The truth is, Laura, how does this project fit into Cranbrook's vision of contemporary art?
Cranbrook Art Museum is really committed to showing the forefront of ideas and in contemporary art and design. And the Truth Booth is both of those. This project is coming at a moment in this time in our country that's incredibly important, but also in our own city, in our own region. Detroit's at a moment that's it's being very self-reflexive of its future, so it seems like a really good fit for this moment. And then as we were planning this tour, the Flint water crisis happened, and so then we decided unanimously it was very important that this project also go to Flint for 3 days to collect videos there as well.
Will, you launched the Truth Booth in Ireland in 2011, ticking it around the world. Why did you want to have it in the U.S. during this election year?
The funny thing is that we planned this tour about a year and a half ago. We started planning, and we had no idea that this election cycle was going to be this chaotic, I guess maybe for the term.
So you're one of those guys who makes a project and serendipity intervenes for you on your behalf.
That's exactly right. And I mean, being able to go to like places like Cleveland and in Philly during this time, and then the follow-up being Detroit and Flint, which is amazing to sort of have that follow-up and continue the conversations that we're having on the road. It is. It's serendipity.
So give me an idea what people are saying when they get in the Truth Booth.
People are speaking about their wants and their needs and the things that really matter to them most in life. We're hearing a lot of stuff about family, a lot of stuff about finances, surprisingly, not a lot of political talk, nothing too much about the candidates and, you know, who's involved. It's mostly about what people need and people want and have in their lives daily.
Laura, tell us about the recordings, how they'll be used in this exhibition that Cranbrook is doing in November. Tell us about that and what it looks like.
So the Truth Booth Tour that's happening the next 2 weeks, that's the opportunity for everyone to speak, and this exhibition is the opportunity for everyone to listen. The artists will be, you know, compiling all of these videos together. We're expecting over 2,000 to be compiled over these 2 weeks, and it'll become a large, over 60-foot video mosaic installation that will be designed by the Cause Collective. There'll also be another sort of participatory installation room filled with speech bubble balloons where people in the exhibition can respond with their own truths at that moment.
Well, you're starting the Southeast Michigan leg at Cranbrook on Sunday from 11 a.m. till 5 p.m., but then you're taking it all over Detroit, Dearborn, Flint for the next couple of weeks. How did you decide on locations?
Oh, I came up there twice, and we drove around a lot, and we spoke to a lot of people, and I had a lot of really great conversations, and that's where it all really came from. We had a lot of really great suggestions from people who live there, and then after being able to tour and visit and just see the sites, it was sort of just like these locations just popped out as locations that we were able to survey Detroit and Flint as a whole.
So when
we were really mindful about where the Truth Booth was going, understanding the demographics of the city. We also really wanted to come here during summer where there were other activities happening, like For the Love of Osborne Parade and the Sidewalk Festival. So this was really important for us to have local anchors in each location where we're going. So there's a collaborative element at each spot, whether that be with an institution or event or a neighborhood organization.
So the people who step into the booth and they record a statement, and then the people who will watch these statements on that big video screen at Cranbrook, what do you guys hope they'll get from this artwork?
My overall goal, I mean, especially with Detroit and Flint, is that, you know, people have an understanding of who these people are. One of the things that I realized before I even came is that there's an impression of places, and especially Detroit and especially Flint, that we have because of what we see on TV and what we hear, you know, the radio and podcasts and read and newspapers. And what I think with the booth that I've always happens to me and I've had to stop doing is I've had to stop assuming. I've had to stop assuming when I see somebody, I know what they're going to say. The great thing about this is that, you know, we will all have to hear from the people themselves. And I think the really cool part is that because it's not leaving, it's also going to be for the people in Detroit, in Flint, and Michigan as a whole to be able to see their neighbors, their community, and learn and understand people who are around them.
Laura, anything you want to add about what you think people should get from this artwork?
I think this is a project that is going to be really amazing to see now, but even 100 years from now, you know, 500 years from now, I think this is going to be a really important document of our time at this moment. And I think even in our current moment, you know, there's a lot of assumptions about different neighborhoods and areas of the city. And, you know, we are hopefully going to be bringing a lot of different voices who aren't typically given that platform to speak and be heard. Really, you know, there's a real hope of generosity that this offers to everyone and that it will extend past the project.
In Search of the Truth, the Truth Booth, which looks like a big inflatable cartoon bubble, will be at the Cranbrook Art Museum this Sunday from 11 to 5. You can get details on the Truth Booth, including the full tour schedule in Southeast Michigan, by going to cranbrookartmuseum.org. Laura Mott is the curator of contemporary art and design at Cranbrook Art Museum, and Will Sylvester is an artist with Cause Collective, the group behind this project. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. During the recession, a lot of people ran into financial trouble. They lost their homes to foreclosure or they were threatened with foreclosure. Some still are. And in Wayne County, the number of homes at risk of tax foreclosure is staggering. The Michigan State Housing Development Authority, also known as MSHDA, has several programs to help eligible people. And here to talk about that is MSHDA Executive Director Kevin Elsenheimer. Let's start with a basic outline of what is MSHDA? What does this agency or authority do?
Well, thank you, Lester. The Michigan State Housing Development Authority is basically Michigan's housing bank, and we perform a lot of different functions. We deal with multifamily housing. We deal with tax credits at the federal level to help develop multifamily housing for low-income people here in Michigan. We have our own mortgage program, which helps lower-income people get mortgages. We also are responsible for the homeless situation in Michigan, so we are responsible for federal dollars going to homeless organizations around the state. But with regard to tax foreclosure and the foreclosure situation in general, we do play a specific role, and that is we are responsible for getting federal dollars out from the TARP program into what we call the Step Forward program.
Right. Step Forward is what we really want to concentrate on today. As you mentioned, it's entirely funded by the federal government. I have numbers from your office that indicate about 124,000 households are registered on your system. But so far, because of fewer applications than that number, and I guess because of eligibility requirements, only about 31,600 households have been approved and funded. How close is that to meeting the need if there's inquiry of 123,000?
Well, there certainly is substantial need. The foreclosure crisis, I suppose, is over, but there are still foreclosures happening both in mortgage foreclosures and also in tax foreclosures. In fact, we've seen a significant number of tax foreclosures continue throughout the state of Michigan. So we're making progress, but there still is demand out there. Is there enough funding to deal with the entire demand issue? No, but our Step Forward program does have funding to help people who do qualify, and there is income qualification, certainly, and you can only access the dollars once. But we do have funding to help people out of a foreclosure crisis.
Even tax foreclosure.
Especially tax foreclosure.
That's an interesting situation because we've heard a number of stories out of Wayne County where people could have gotten poverty waivers for their taxes, mm-hmm. didn't realize it, didn't apply for it, and then find out they're going to lose their house because they weren't able to pay the taxes for the last 3 years when really sure. they probably didn't have to pay the taxes. The flip side of that is, you know, I can't help but wonder if city and county officials don't make people aware of the poverty exemptions because if they did, they'd lose that much more revenue. But they're losing the revenue anyway and having to deal with the empty house.
Yeah, I can't speak to the issue of whether or not the local treasurers are dealing with the poverty issue or how they're dealing with that. But I can tell you that the State Treasurers Association has been very, very aggressive and a great partner in getting information out to people either coming to the counter, making phone calls about what they're receiving in the mail with regard to the tax foreclosures. And they know exactly how to get those people to our office so that we can help those people qualify for funding. We have helped thousands of people statewide, and frankly helped communities with their funding issues to get those federal dollars to pay some of those local taxes and keep people in their homes.
So let's talk about eligibility. What kind of income limits are we talking about? Who's eligible? Who's not?
It's an income test and it's an asset test. So not everyone is going to be eligible, but generally, and I say generally because there are some specific rules that may impact individual people. Generally, people who are at about 60% of the area median income are going to be potentially eligible. Again, there's asset tests. There are other things that are looked at. But that's consistent with other kinds of federal assistance eligibility requirements. And many people who are in that situation will kind of know where they fit in if they qualify for other kinds of funding, other kinds of support, for example. And people in that situation very likely or very possibly will qualify, but they should certainly contact their local treasurer and they should certainly contact MSHDA.gov Step Forward to take a look at whether or not they're eligible.
So let's talk about assets just a little bit. You mean like a second house or a big bank account sitting someplace or things like that, right?
That's right. These dollars are obviously intended to go for people who simply don't have another option to help keep them in their home. We are looked at very, very closely by the federal government as to whether or not we're getting these assets out to the right people. I think that's what we would all want. We want to make sure that the dollars are going where they truly are in need. And I can tell you that we certainly are getting lots of communications from state treasurers all around the state of Michigan as to people who they think may qualify. They refer them to us, and we help an awful lot of them out.
Now, we see Wayne County and Detroit having this really just a tidal wave of tax foreclosures. Is that happening in other places in the state?
It is certainly the largest area of a problem, if you will, if that's the right way to put it. It certainly is a problem if you're in that situation. Wayne County is certainly the largest recipient of those dollars, both the city of Detroit and Wayne County. But that certainly isn't limited to Wayne County. We have very active programs in Kalamazoo, very active programs in Oakland County. We're getting money all over the state of Michigan with people who are still suffering from the foreclosure crisis and not able to pay their taxes.
As you mentioned, mortgage foreclosures, not as much of a problem, but mortgage foreclosures, that's not gone away. About how many people are you helping now a year in that kind of a situation? Because I think a lot of people aren't aware. I know anecdotally, I know someone who during the crisis thought they might lose their home.
Sure.
I told them about this program, but it seemed complicated to them and they didn't pursue it. And I just thought, wow, your house at risk just because the process seems complicated. That was surprising. So are there people out there now? We're still seeing foreclosures. Are you not reaching them? Are you not telling them, hey, there's a helping hand here if you need it?
You know, we certainly are trying. And we've got, as I said, thousands and thousands of people that have been helped. But there is a little bit of confusion out there with regard to the program that has caused us a little trouble in the last 6 months. We ran out of money last year, and we actually closed the window to fund these hardest hit Step Forward programs around December or January of last year or January of this year. And didn't receive any additional funding until early 2016. So there was a period of time where if you called, we would probably tell you we don't have anything for you. That has created some issues. We now are funded. We have millions and millions of dollars available to go ahead and use to help people out in that situation. So if someone is in a situation where maybe they called us and we're concerned about the paperwork or we're concerned about the fact that we told them no money was available, money is available now, and we do have those assets, and we want to get them out there so people can stay in their homes.
What's the bottom line here besides public awareness and hopefully a less complicated system? Because I haven't applied for one, so I don't know how complicated it is. Can you do it online? Do you have to go to an office? What do you do to apply for these funds if you find yourself in dire straits?
We have about 60 people working in Lansing in the Romney building who occupy one floor of the Romney building who do nothing but assist people around the state day in and day out. A lot of their communications are electronic, so if you have access to a computer, it makes it very, very simple. We'll accept documents electronically, PDFs, et cetera, scans, and use those documents to work with a mortgage company or to work with a county treasurer in order to help qualify someone for benefits. It's as simple as we can make it, but nothing federal is easy. So there are certainly rules that have to be followed and I's that have to be dotted, T's crossed. But I can tell you this, we have a wall in that office that is probably 30 feet long, and that wall is full of thank you cards from people who've written the most amazing notes saying, thank you so much for helping save our home and save our family. So the system is working. There are always, I mean, it is government. There are always things that we can improve, and we're working to do that. But if anyone has these kinds of concerns or thinks they might be eligible, if they're in foreclosure, then they should certainly contact us. And the first step would be to look at MSHDA.gov.
That's MSHDA.gov, and that's the place to get started if you find yourself in that boat. That is Kevin Elsenheimer. He is the executive director of MSHDA. That's the Michigan State Housing Development Authority. And if you find yourself in foreclosure and you think you might meet the income eligibility, take the time. It might be a complicated process, but it could save your house.
It could save your house. And frankly, we've got people who can probably give you some advice even if you don't qualify. Now, they're not going to give you legal advice, but they can tell you, have you talked to your mortgage lender? Have you talked to your banker? Because, again, our team sees people in this situation every single day. There's a phone number on the website. Give us a call, and we'll get right back to you and help you out.
Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. If you live in Kalamazoo, your real estate taxes are going down. Here's why. Some private donors have come up with $70 million to help the city, and the city commission has decided to create a foundation that for the future will subsidize property taxes. So according to the Kalamazoo Gazette, if your house is worth $100,000, your taxes will drop from $963 a year to $600 a year. This continues a trend of private giving to help cities out. The big one came during Detroit's bankruptcy and the so-called Grand Bargain. But private donations are testing rape kits, supplying bottled water and filters to Flint, places where government is just not cutting it. So what do you think of that? Send a tweet to @StatesideRadio or directly to me @MichiganWatch. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.